Everybody, if we could all sit down and get started, we would appreciate it. My name is Maria Palante. I'm the Associate Register for Policy and International Affairs here at the U.S. Copyright Office. And special appreciation and thanks to all of you who have traveled here today to be with us. I would like to give you a quick overview of the day, and then I will introduce the government team sitting up here. And then I will hand it over to Mary Beth Peters, the Register of Copyrights, for opening remarks. If you haven't found the restrooms, you go out the door and make a left. If you haven't found the cafeteria, you go out the door and bear to your right. We're going to go until 10 o'clock. We're going to start at 10 with the panel overview, the statements from you. We're going to go until 11:30. We'll probably have a quick break. There's not one on the agenda, but we're anticipating that we'll all need one at that point. And then we'll go again until 1 p.m., and we'll break for lunch until 2:30. The cafeteria is open to the public. You're welcome to use it. You're welcome to go outside as long as you're all back by 2:30. So to my left is Michael Shapiro, Attorney Advisor, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and head of the U.S. delegation for the SCCR. To his left is Neil Graham, Attorney Advisor, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and a member of the delegation as well. To my immediate right is Michelle Woods, Senior Counsel for Policy and International Affairs here at the U.S. Copyright Office, and a member of the delegation. And Stephen Tepp, to her right, also Senior Counsel for Policy and International Affairs, U.S. Copyright Office, and a member of the delegation. Sitting behind us in the corner are Jackie Morales, also from the Patent and Trademark Office legal staff, and Paula Pena, who many of you have spoken to on the phone, from the U.S. Copyright Office legal staff. And buzzing around is Lisa Oates, who is our legal assistant, and if anybody has any other questions, feel free to grab her. So our first panel this morning will focus on the existing statutory regime. We'll follow that with a discussion of existing initiatives. And after lunch, we'll get to possible actions and solutions to enhance access. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Honorable Mary Beth Peters, Register of Copyrights, who has been Register of Copyrights here since 1994, for opening remarks. Thank you.
Good morning. I would like to add my thanks to all of you for coming today. Copyright Office is extremely pleased to host this public meeting, and I'm happy that we're, for some of us, in a place where we have windows. It makes a difference to me to be able to at least see the light, and I think we're going to be enlightened throughout the day with all of the remarks that you are going to be making. Obviously, the topic is facilitating access to copyrighted works for the blind and other persons with disability. And we very much appreciate that some members of our panel and some of the audience have traveled significant distances to be here today. It is going to be a long day, but in fact, probably not long enough, given the complexity of the legal and practical challenges we will be discussing. The meeting today is part of a diligent and comprehensive process of fact-finding undertaken by my office and the United States Patent and Trademark Office to prepare for the forthcoming meeting of the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights at the World Intellectual Property Organization. That meeting will take place in Geneva on May 25th to 29th, and member countries will exchange information about national laws and experience relating to access to copyrighted works for the blind. In recent months, the Copyright Office and the Patent and Trademark Office have held informal meetings with stakeholders, including members of the blind community, book publishers, and the whole purpose of those meetings has been to gain a better understanding of the confluence of factors that affect the availability of accessible formats. From the implementation of the Chafee Amendment and disabilities laws to promote or to bring about the promise of technology and to look at some of the frustrations of inadequate resources. On March 26, we commenced a formal consultation process through a notice of inquiry published in the Federal Register, requesting written comments and reply comments on a wide range of questions. We thank the many nonprofit organizations, libraries, commercial businesses, and private citizens who took time to write and contribute to the record, including the National Federation of the Blind, the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, the Association of American Book Publishers, the DAISY Consortium, RFB&D, Public Knowledge, Benetech, Accessible Publishing, the American Library Association, Knowledge Ecology International, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Software and Information and Industry Association, Motion Picture Association, and others. These comments form the basis for the meeting today and may be viewed on our website at www.copyright.gov. We are fortunate to have diverse interests and perspectives at the table today, including authors who create books, the book publishers who create viable markets, the libraries who provide critical services to the blind, and the nonprofit entities who adapt works into accessible formats, and organizations who are concerned with the public interest and well-being of those who are not otherwise represented. As we listen to these esteemed speakers, we will focus on two overarching themes. One, how do people or entities in the United States utilize or share accessible copies of United States works within the United States? Second, how do people or entities in the United States access foreign works or share accessible copies of U.S. works across borders? Today, we start from the premise that improving the quality, quantity, and timeliness of accessible materials for the blind or other persons with disabilities is an important goal that requires and deserves continuous effort. We invite our speakers to think creatively and collaboratively to this end, and I and my colleagues here all look forward to hearing from all of you. So thank you, and let's begin. Back to you.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Okay, what I'd like to do now is introduce the participants. And on my left, going clockwise around the room, we have Paul Aiken from the Authors Guild. We have Rashmi Rangnath from Public Knowledge. We have Ellen Adler from the Association of American Publishers. We have Scott Labar from the National Federation of the Blind. We have George Kircher from the DAISY Consortium. Brad Thomas, RFB&D. Gary Mudd, American Printing House for the Blind. Ed O'Reilly from National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And last but not least, Peter Chapman from Pearson Publishing. I will start with Paul for opening statements. You have 5 minutes and 2 points on this. We are being recorded because we will have an audio file on our website with the transcript. There will also be a written transcript, so please speak clearly and take your time. That said, you have 5 minutes, and if you exceed your 5 minutes, you'll hear a very polite bell, and maybe Paula could demonstrate that for us. And if you hear that, if you could please stop talking, we would appreciate it, because if we don't get past the opening statements, we won't have time for questions and a discussion. So with that, Paul, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here this morning and today to discuss this important issue. Let me start briefly with history of the Authors Guild, for those who don't know it. We were founded in 1912 as the Authors League of America. Our mission is to look out for the business and copyright contractual interests and the free speech interests of authors. The Authors League, soon after its founding, became a number of organizations, which you're probably familiar with, the Authors Guild, Dramatists Guild, Writers Guild, East and West. We represent book authors and freelance journalists, but primarily book authors, and they publish in every genre, fiction, nonfiction, textbooks, academic authors are all represented in the Guild. And we have more than 8,500 published authors as our members. We're the largest organization of book authors in the United States. Authors want everyone to have access to books. We always have. Authors love readers. It's why we're in the business. For this reason, for decades, authors donated rights so that Braille editions and audio versions could be created for the visually impaired and the print disabled. And then in 1996, of course, the Chafee Amendment gave an explicit copyright exception for such uses. But our donations continue today. There still are clauses in book contracts which says that authors surrender royalties for the blind and physically disabled that go beyond the bounds of Chafee. However, saying that, we also have economic rights that are, of course, important to us and that we have to protect. And the challenge in moving from print to digital couldn't be clearer. Anyone who reads one of the fast-disappearing newspapers knows exactly what's going on. As print moves to digital, it is exceedingly hard to land on a viable business model. Newspapers, it is said, are disappearing in the United States at the rate of one per week. Even the New York Times is challenged in this environment, and there are questions about whether it can, in the long run, avoid bankruptcy, which is just a shocking statement to those of us who grew up with newspapers and value them. Magazines are in an equally difficult position as they move from print to digital. In today's New York Times, you can read about Wired magazine, published by Chris Anderson, who knows as much about the digital divide and how to make money as anyone could imagine. He's the one who popularized the concept of the long tail in publishing, and even he is struggling in this environment. So this isn't the environment and the challenge that we face in book publishing. We're making the leap to digital, whether we like it or not. And we've got to land on a viable business model. A little more context. The history of electronic book rights goes back, importantly, to 1993, when Random House, then as now the largest trade book publisher, issued a new contract, which caused a huge controversy in the industry. We called it a land grab on the electronic frontier, and Amazon was essentially wanted to take all rights for creation of electronic books. We saw the problems immediately with that, as did literary agents and anyone paying attention in the industry. One of the big problems, beyond the meager royalties that Random House was offering at the time, was that Random House wanted to take electronic rights not just for display, but for multimedia uses, for audio and visual uses. And we saw immediately that there was a conflict with the rights that authors place with others, with audiobook publishers, with movie producers. These rights are distinct. They're exclusively placed with others. And an electronic book that bundles in with it audio rights would challenge these other contracts that the authors had exclusively placed elsewhere and which they rely on, and which, in audiobooks, now represents a $1 billion industry, far bigger than the electronic book industry. So a compromise was arrived at, and that compromise was that the print book publisher, in almost all cases, does get ebook rights, but it's the pure text electronic right, that is, the right to display, I'll wrap up in a moment, the right to display the ebook in digital form. That does not come bundled with any audio or visual rights. Those rights are retained by the author and agent and must be explicitly granted in order for those rights to be exercised, in order to prevent a conflict with rights the author may have placed elsewhere. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Rashmi.
Thank you, Maria. I'd like to thank the Copyright Office for inviting me to be on this panel. I represent Public Knowledge, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization that represents the public stake in access to knowledge. I want to address the issue of mainstream access today. As many in this panel will probably testify and comments submitted in these proceedings reflect, the blind deserve mainstream access, that is the ability to walk into a bookstore and buy a book like anybody else, get it at the same time and approximately at the same price as sighted individuals. We believe that adaptive technologies will enable mainstream access and should be encouraged. Adaptive technologies enable the blind to access ebooks and digital publications at the same time as sighted individuals, with the movement to digital, with the movement of more books and publications to digital formats, adaptive technologies hold the promise to deliver mainstream access. The Copyright Office has acknowledged this in its 2003 and 2006 1201 rulemaking proceedings, when it said that the e-book holds tremendous value for the blind, although as an industry, it's a nascent industry. The other benefits of adaptive technologies are that they are not constrained by limitations in Section 121, in that anybody can make these technologies and anybody can access books using them without qualifying under the definitions of the blind under the Chafee Amendment. They do not violate any copyrights, as they facilitate non-infringing use. Again, the office acknowledged this position in the 2003 and 2006 rulemaking proceedings, 1201 rulemaking proceedings. The other important benefit of adaptive technology is that it would overcome the resource crunch which many have said exists in converting books to accessible formats. So we think that adaptive technologies should be encouraged, and market practices that hinder the use of adaptive technologies should be discouraged. For example, although technology vendors make available products that have features that work with adaptive technologies, for example, ebooks come with these features, but they are disabled because of pressure from publishers that features such as text-to-speech interfere with copyrights and audiobook rights. A lot of e-books come wrapped in DRM that prevent use of adaptive technologies, and the office has provided an exemption in the 2003 and 2006 proceedings to allow the blind to circumvent this DRM in order to be able to access digital publications. We believe that these exemptions should be made permanent. The DMCA should be amended to allow circumvention in order to access ebooks and other digital publications. And there should be an amendment to Section 1201A2 in order to enable others to market technologies that would enable circumvention. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you. I just want to take a couple of minutes to focus on the two lessons that we tried to draw from the past 13 years of work that I have been involved with on behalf of the Association of American Publishers and its members in the book publishing community in attempting to meet the needs of individuals with print disabilities. From the very beginning, we've talked about that issue as if we were talking about a homogenous group of people, as if we were talking about a single set of problems to be met, presumably with a single set of solutions. And indeed, the Chafee Amendment was the beginning of the application of a regulatory approach to attempting to deal with these needs. It was a regulatory approach that in many ways assumed it was a singular set of problems to be dealt with, and that most of the people who were in need of assistance were dealing with those issues in the same context and in the same way. But over the years, we've learned that that's clearly not true. We have spent a lot of time dealing with state legislatures, enacting legislation to address this issue. We've spent a fair amount of time working with Congress and the Department of Education to address these issues. And we find that when we're talking about them on different levels of government, when we're talking about them on the one hand in the context of the needs of students who have print disabilities, as opposed to individuals who are not talking about the needs that they have in connection with the academic endeavor, but simply as part of their ability to fully enjoy their lives, we're talking about people in different contexts and different circumstances, and therefore the solutions aren't all the same. So one lesson we have learned is that the rapid development of technology and our evolving understanding of human disabilities can quickly change and challenge the basic assumptions underlying even the most carefully crafted regulatory approach to meeting the accessibility needs of individuals with print disabilities. And that leads to assertions that the supporting law or regulation is outdated in its scope and should be applied more broadly to effectuate current needs. And we're seeing those calls now in connection with the Chafee Amendment. But more importantly, over the 13 years, this evolution of technology development and our understanding of human disabilities and our approach to defining them has now changed the underlying assumptions that justified the existence of a regulatory approach in the first place, and seems to point in the direction of moving steadily and surely towards a market-based approach as the best way to deal with these issues. So in that context, the other lesson we have drawn, and I hope to have a further opportunity to discuss, is that one-size-fits-all solutions aren't necessary, they aren't appropriate, and they aren't sufficient to meet the accessibility needs of all individuals with print disabilities. And imposing such solutions by regulatory mandates will only delay the introduction of more effective market-based responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Mr. Labar.
Greetings. I am here today on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind. In particular, I bring you greetings from our president, Dr. Mark Maurer, who has asked me to come here today and speak on behalf of blind and visually impaired individuals in this country. And it is hard for me in a situation like this to sort of keep separate the objective issues and the intellectual issues from the personal, because I am indeed one of the individuals affected by this discussion. When we talk about copyrighted materials and getting greater access to them, we are talking about people like me and the people that I represent. And it is a crucial issue for us because there is the old adage that knowledge equals power. And it gets thrown around so much that I think it sometimes loses its potency. But it is indeed one of the fundamental truths of being involved in the human experience. As a class of people, blind people have been limited in our access to knowledge, and therefore our access to power. Technology gives us a framework, a way to access knowledge that we have never previously had. I understand that some complex issues of copyright and legality and protection of intellectual property arise out of technology. However, for us, the issue is quite simple. We insist upon access to as much information and knowledge as possible, and we will work very vigorously to confront any artificial barriers to accessing that knowledge. And I look forward to the discussion today about specifically how we can develop a flexible regulatory scheme that would protect intellectual property, yet give us the access that we demand and deserve. It would be ironic that with the evolution of technology that has the promise of bringing so much more to our fingertips, that the same technology would be used to limit and restrict our access to knowledge and therefore our access to power. So I want to thank the Copyright Office and all the other governmental entities that are sponsoring this today for allowing us to participate and allowing the voice of the blind to be heard.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kircher.
Thank you very much for having me here today. The DAISY Consortium is made up of libraries and organizations worldwide who provide services to people who are blind and print disabled. And I do come with a worldwide perspective. There's a fundamental, a principle that I think will help guide things along, and that's that we envision a world where people with disabilities have access to information and knowledge at the same time and without additional costs. We've used the term the same book at the same time at the same price, and that really does kind of sum it up. We are absolutely committed to working hand in glove with publishers as partners. We want to see the mainstream market solution. We also believe that there's a need for a copyright exception to make sure that materials are available in all sectors. The same book is a loaded term because we want to be able to have full function access, a fully accessible book, not something that is crippled or partially usable. We want to be able to use the same features and functions as the non-disabled population enjoy. And we've been burned in this respect because companies have come out with a product and it's doesn't work for people with disabilities, and their marketing department will hang the term accessible on top of it. Accessible this, accessible that. It has maybe one or two accessibility features, and yet their marketing department is very good at selling these things, and they convince the general population that this is indeed accessible to everybody when it's not. So, same book, we need full functionality. The Chafee population that's being served today is based on the physical disabilities, and what we're finding in our society, and many of the comments that have come in are talking about people with learning disabilities that need to be served. I believe that the functional disability should be referenced. If people have a disability that prevents them from effectively using print, then they should be allowed to access information under the copyright exceptions. I think this is just one of the fundamentals of equality that we believe in the United States. So I'd like to see us move in that direction. The specialized formats is one of the items that is brought up. And the DAISY Consortium has worked on developing modern technologies and techniques. And we're seeing the DAISY technology being moved into things like the EPUB standard. So the DAISY XML and the DAISY navigation model is sitting there in the commercial products in digital publishing. And remember that we have the goal of the same book at the same price at the same time. So we're using technology strategically to make sure it's accessible to everybody. So the formats that should be allowed are those that are universally designed and accessible to people with disabilities. Those may be adopted by the mainstream community. And that would be great because it gets us closer to our goal and our principle of equal access. So the EPUB specification was developed by the publishing community and technology companies, and many of us in the disability community were there. We're committed from the beginning to accessibility, and built into the standard are statements that this information is intended to be rendered by user agents, reading systems, in the best way that's most palatable for the person with a disability. That might be through refreshable Braille. We know that many of the displays have large character fonts. And, of course, text-to-speech is one of those options. And all of those have been anticipated in the EPUB standard. We know that the Authors Guild is selling recording rights, but the fundamental rights of access to the information, I think, should be preserved, and text-to-speech should be an option that's available to all people reading e-books. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas.
Good morning. I'm Brad Thomas with Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, and I just want to thank the Copyright and Patent Offices for including us in this conversation. We're excited to be here and look forward to this dialogue. I want to speak briefly for a moment about the Chafee Amendment specifically and a couple of technical issues that we've experienced with the implementation of the Chafee Amendment, and then speak more broadly to issues of copyright exemptions and the like. As most of you know, RFBND was heavily involved with many other organizations in the mid-90s in crafting and implementing the Chafee Amendment, and we believe that it's been a huge success in facilitating access to accessible materials for blind, visually impaired, and other print disability populations. Prior to the Chafee Amendment, copyright permissions had to be acquired in an individual process that was quite onerous on the publishers and on RFBND, and created significant delays for individuals who needed the materials unnecessarily. Passage of the Chafee Amendment, however, granted us and other authorized entities proactive access to these permissions, greatly expediting the availability of materials to individuals that needed them. And we've worked very carefully with the publishing community and disability advocacy organizations to implement the Chafee Amendment in a way that guaranteed access to individuals who legitimately are eligible and have need of these materials while protecting the legitimate rights of authors and publishers. There have, however, arisen two particular issues related to the implementation of the Chafee Amendment that I would like to address. The first is the area of the eligible population, and we believe that that area is in need of significant clarification. And of course, I'm talking about the eligibility of those with learning disabilities under the Chafee Amendment. We have certainly taken the position that certain students with learning disabilities qualify under the Physical Limitations Clause based on our understanding from the research that learning disabilities are based on physiological impairments. Obviously, we believe that research backs up that interpretation, and we believe that these individuals have a legitimate need for accessible content, particularly in the case of K-12 students, where their access to that content is guaranteed by other federal laws. But we certainly acknowledge that this is a gray area. We've worked carefully with other stakeholders to address this, but I believe clarification from the appropriate entities would be useful. The second area is the area of competent authority. In other words, who has authority to certify a student or other individual as having a print disability. Similarly, we believe that the requirement that a medical professional certify someone with a reading disability is not supported by the research, and that clarification would again be useful in this circumstance. Again, it creates conflict with other federal laws, for example, IDEA, where educational professionals are primarily responsible for identifying students with special needs and determining what accommodations are appropriate. So bringing copyright law into line with those federal civil rights statutes would be an important part of this process. I also want to speak more broadly now about the existence of the copyright exemption and calls for significant changes to it. I want to be very clear. RFBND is greatly encouraged by the development of market-based approaches to facilitate wider access to these materials for individuals with special needs. We have been in discussions with publishers, with authors, about how RFBND can be partners with them as they approach this issue, and we believe that great promise is out there. But I also want to be clear that I think there will always be, or for the foreseeable future at least, be a need for RFBND and other organizations like ours. While great strides have been made in facilitating access in a broader sense from the publishers, much work still needs to be done. And much work even still needs to be done from the number of smaller publishers that are in existence that don't have the same technical capacity. And then one other quick comment. I believe that organizations like RFBND can draw on our history of working with these populations to ensure that access to the materials lead to meaningful outcomes and that access is not just an empty promise. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mudd.
Thank you, Maria. Good morning. And on behalf of the American Printing House for the Blind, we appreciate the opportunity to speak before the group today. I wanted to touch on a little history as well as our mission before we make any comments on. In 1879, the Congress passed the Act to Promote the Education of the Blind and designated the American Printing House for the Blind as the official supplier of textbooks and other materials. Eligible students include all students in the United States who meet the definition of blindness and who are working at less than college level. Today, there are approximately 59,000 students registered with the printing house, and Congress appropriates funds under this act that allows the state and to acquire textbooks and other educational materials from APH. After our APH works directly with service providers, teachers, who assist students in developing the skills they need to cultivate literature and to access tactile graphics, and other educational content in accessible formats. APH's educational experience and research affirms the continued need for embossed braille and tactile graphics in textbooks. In pursuing our mission of providing accessible educational materials to K through 12 students, APH is deeply grateful for the Chafee Amendment. Excuse me. Since 1996, the Chafee Amendment has been hugely beneficial to us in providing accessible textbooks, especially in Braille, to students who are blind. The amendment in IDEA 2004 to permit large type has only expanded our appreciation for the Chafee Amendment for reproducing elementary and secondary textbooks. Students with visual disabilities need timely materials. They also need materials that truly provide access to the complete educational content in an appropriate format. This prescriptive approach could include hard copy, braille, and tactile graphics, the large print, refreshable braille displays, and audio. We too believe and are excited about the technology of the day, but we also want to keep a focus on the delivery and production of Braille because many, many students still use Braille. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Reilly.
Yes, thank you for inviting us. I'm from the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, part of the Library of Congress. We've been busy providing books since 1931 to a population of blind, visually impaired, and physically handicapped users, patrons who must duly register. We model ourselves specifically, explicitly after a decent middle-sized public library, we like to say, and we also like to say that we provide for the recreational and informational needs of our patrons. That means, on the whole, we don't serve students. Students, of course, are welcome to use our materials, but we don't do textbooks. We leave that to sister organizations. We don't do technical, scientific, and academic material. At the present time, produce about 2,000 audiobooks annually in something like 2 million copies, and additionally about 600 Braille books. That's probably a low number by the standards of the gentleman to my right. And we don't know what to say about that at the moment. I too think that the Braille initiatives should be promoted, that we should do whatever is possible to encourage Braille literacy. Meanwhile, we're in the midst of a massive change from audio cassette technology, analog technology, to digital audio. We have just launched what we call in-house our pre-launch test. It's the final massive test of something like 5,000 machines among a select group of libraries before the implementation of mass production of these. This is just literally days since these have been issued, and we've gotten some very, very positive news so far. We anticipate some negative feedback, and that's what the test is for, of course, because we don't want to go to mass production, 26,000 machines a month for the first year with built-in imperfections. That would be silly. We are at the present time wrapping our books in DRM, and they're heavily encrypted and password protected, and we are also committed at the present time to human voice renditions of books. Our eligible population is one that we do not ask technological sophistication. So computer delivery is something that we are making available of digital books, but we're not requiring it. The machines are easy to use, and anecdotal evidence has suggested that people are finding them simpler and more accessible than our very accessible C1 analog cassette machine. This is a fascinating and fluid time, and I'm here as much to be educated as to supply any information that I can. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chapman.
Good morning. My name is Peter Chapman. I'm a product director for ebook platforms at Pearson Education in Boston. As such, I'm really a technologist with responsibilities to develop some of the broad digital technologies Pearson provides to its customer base. For those of you unfamiliar with Pearson, we are the world's leading education publisher in K-12 and higher education. Our imprints include Scott Forsman and Prentice Hall. Pearson is also the publisher of Penguin Books, the Financial Times, and the Economist magazine, amongst others. Pearson appreciates the Copyright Office's invitation to attend this hearing, and being the last speaker on the panel, I'll just make a very brief statement on my company's behalf. My company's message to the Copyright Office and the audience is quite simple and echoes that of some of the preceding speakers. We simply believe that the existing statutory provisions work against the development of a robust market model. Despite the well-minded intentions of its original framers, the Chafee Amendment has at times been used by a variety of organizations to pick and choose from millions of dollars worth of content and without compensation to the original publisher, sell or otherwise give away access to product to users, some of whom may be of only questionable eligibility. Through our long time involvement in working to create solutions for students with disabilities, we have come to believe that while it was a functional model in the pre-digital and pre-learning disabilities expansion, the Chafee exemption now stands between publishers and the development of a robust market model. Educational publishers such as Pearson now labor under NIMRS regulations whereby millions of dollars are invested in creating a format that is not immediately student user ready. The NIMRS regulations also stand between publishers and the development of this true market model that would better serve the needs of students in the future. So it is for these reasons that Pearson Education does not support the extension of the terms of the Chafee Amendment beyond the borders of the United States. Thank you.
Thank you. And the good news is we're ahead of time, so we have more time for discussion. I'd like to turn to my, I have three colleagues who have immediate questions. We'll start with Stephen Tepp, who has a question about resources. And then we'll move to Michelle Woods, who has a question about DRM, and then to Michael Shapiro, who has some questions about market public-private partnerships. So, Steve?
Thanks, Maria. Maybe more than one question, but not too many, I hope. I would like to spend some time exploring the market economics of accessibility. It's evident from the written comments that we've received that there are issues on both the supply side and the demand side. With regard to the supply side, I note Mr. Tinsley's comments from the American Printing House for the Blind seem to speak for everyone when he wrote in his comment, inadequate resources affect every level. Similarly, Mr. Fruchterman of Benetech and Bookshare concluded that, quote, there are insufficient resources to fully solve the accessibility problem. That lack of resources appears to be exacerbated by the relatively high cost of producing accessible works and duplicative production efforts, which then compete for the relatively small demand for those works. Dr. Maurer of the National Federation of the Blind provided an example of this when he wrote in his comment that many of the books in question are of such limited interest that the effort to produce them twice has the practical result of having them be unobtainable for some who would like to read them. Recently, a student reported that getting a transcripted copy of a mathematics text cost him $2,500. So the first set of questions I'd like to ask the entire panel is, in light of that rather grim picture, do any of the organizations that provide works in specialized formats do so at a profit? Do any break even? Why is that? And I invite anyone on the panel who'd like to address that, but probably first the organizations that actually do provide accessible works.
And let's just do this. If you do want to comment, if you could just raise your hand and we'll write your name down, and from time to time we'll call out the names. So we have Mr. Labar and Mr. Mudd and Mr. Thomas. Okay, we'll start with that. Mr. Labar.
I can't precisely speak to the cost of providing materials because the role of the National Federation of the Blind is not directly to produce these accessible texts. However, our members and therefore the consumers of such services know how difficult it has been traditionally to get materials put into an accessible format. The more technical the area, such as mathematics, of course, the higher the cost. I remember very well how difficult it was always to get the math texts I needed into Braille in a timely fashion. That is why, in my opening remarks, I made the comment that it would be a tragedy, really, that with the way that technology can fix this problem, that the same technology be used to shut off access. The recent issue involving the Kindle 2 is a primary example. We have a ready-to-use platform where a blind person, in the same exact manner, could go and get the device, order a book, and have access, as Mr. Kircher said, at the same time, same book, same time, same price. Yet, that access, in many regards, now has been shut off due to the argument that copyright is infringed. And so I think that what we have to keep in mind is that the high cost of producing books in accessible formats is coming down. And we have to make sure that we do not create barriers that allow technology to put books more easily into Braille, more easily into text-to-speech, etc. I know, and I'm sure recordings for the blind and dyslexic and others would like to speak to this, but traditionally the costs have been high, and these organizations do not operate at a profit. The Library of Congress obviously does not operate at a profit. It is our public library, and it is an expensive public library in the sense that it has to do a lot more work to bring books to a person like me than other libraries need to do. And, of course, because of the very high cost of so doing, not the same volume of books is available to me as to others.
Okay, Mr. Mudd, thank you.
Thank you. Let me speak a little bit to the fact we are, as well, a nonprofit, 501c3. Let me talk a little bit about the production of a Braille textbook. And we'll use math again, for instance, because Scott talked about it as well. Math and science are some of the hardest and most difficult materials to transcribe into Braille. We usually start with a digital copy of the book, but the real expense comes with the editing and transcribing of Braille, which takes a human brain still. And fortunately, what it does is that someone has to interpret what the author is intended to teach, what concept. Many times you get visually much more quickly, but we have to transcribe into a meaningful, useful, tactile graphic. And that is probably the most expensive part of creating a book. And as many of you know, textbooks are becoming more and more visual. So we have to transcribe that concept into a meaningful tactile graphic that kids can use. True translation programs have helped us tremendously in transcribing a book from a digital form into a Braille form. But it's still the pictures, the charts, the graphs that take that human brain to interpret and therefore understand how a Braille reader best learns with the tactile graphic that needs to be used in the book. I don't know whether that answers your question, Stephen, or whether that further complicates things, but that's just some of what goes into the transcription of a digital book into a useful Braille learning tool.
Okay. Thank you. It does certainly go to answering why the costs are so high, at least with specifically regard to Braille editions of math and science textbooks. If you could add anything as to the overall economics of the market, that is, can you sell the copies you produce at a break-even point, or you know, and if not, how do you continue to operate?
Oftentimes what happens is we work with a network of transcribers nationwide. And sometimes the finished product, the digital to Braille textbook, can't, or at least if it's paid for with state funding, for instance, Texas, they believe that the laws tell them to keep it within the state boundaries. We pay transcribers for the transcription, and then we use that transcription to duplicate the copies. What has happened over the years, especially in Braille, is that in the, well, let's say 50 years ago, before the digital, many books that we transcribed into Braille were duplicated and sent throughout the country. The first copy of a book was adopted by several states and then duplicated, which kept the price fairly low. Today, with site-based decision-making, there are many more titles needed. So the same effort needs to go into, even though digital delivery has helped tremendously, transcribing it into a useful Braille learning tool with tactile graphics has kept the price relatively high, as well as the number of copies. We do no longer make 500 copies of a book, which can drive the price, keep it down. Now, oftentimes, we make just one, two, three copies of a book, which keeps it fairly expensive. Does that help clear up, if I can answer any more?
It does. Thank you.
And I believe Mr. Thomas wanted to say something about cost and resources.
Sure, and I can make it quick. It's certainly, we are a nonprofit as well, and certainly are not breaking even or obviously producing a profit with our efforts, similar to what you've heard elsewhere. It is an expensive proposition. New technology surrounding text, but also recording techniques are bringing the cost down, but it's hard to foresee a future where a break-even point or a profit point could be realized by us. I mean, I assume it's theoretically possible, but it would be cost prohibitive for the end user and would certainly violate our spirit of being a nonprofit.
Okay. I've got Alan Adler and then Dr. Kircher, if anybody else wants, and then Mr. Aiken. Alan.
Well, I just wanted to point out that when you're talking about the issue of the adequacy of available resources, it's again a contextual issue that differs depending upon the circumstances you're discussing it. When we're talking about the regulatory approach that was ushered in under the Chafee Amendment, it was not surprising that amendment was adopted by Congress with the basic understanding that the immediate beneficiaries were going to be the National Library Service, the American Printing House, and the Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, all of which were, over the years, have received appropriations from the federal government in support of their work, as you might expect with a regulatory approach. But that hasn't always worked in other sectors. For example, in leading up to the IDEA amendments of 2004, when we were working with a broad array of advocacy groups for the disabilities community, one of the notions was that part of the problem in getting timely access for students at the elementary and secondary school levels, which is a very highly centralized process with respect to how instructional materials actually are selected and purchased for that group, the fact was that you're still dealing with a situation where if in the end immediate need is going to be served under the Chafee Amendment by, for example, scanning a textbook so that that book can be used with text-to-screen translation software, the scanning of it is something that is being done in a just-in-time fashion, which means it's not scheduled, it's not something that necessarily can be accounted for in budgetary considerations in advance, especially because we were told that students can't be tracked with respect to their need from one grade to another because there are problems with that, apparently, under civil rights laws. When you shift your focus to higher education, which is a much more decentralized process with respect to how instructional materials are gathered, the problem becomes even worse, because there, every student ultimately is responsible for acquiring whatever books the faculty member of a particular course says are required reading. And that array of books, by definition, is going to be far more diverse than the array of books that are used at the elementary and secondary school level. And they may include novels and works of popular nonfiction, as well as a wide variety of other works, some of which have difficulty in terms of how they're reproduced. Now, part of the idea of the IDEA amendments was that we wanted to move away from this patchwork quilt of state law requirements, some of which asked publishers for files in off-the-shelf electronic formats like Microsoft Word, or some of them even would prefer if the publisher gave them an ASCII file. And the problem with that, of course, was that an ASCII file is something that the publisher would first have to create out of its own production files by stripping down the kind of tagging activity that had created a more sophisticated and versatile file. And the publisher has no use for that file after creating it. And when that file is used as the source file for conversion in order to create, recreate the work in specialized formats for use by people with print disabilities, the expense involved in retagging an ASCII file is extraordinary because it's very laborious. So in the education context, when you're talking about the availability of resources and you're relying upon the regulatory approach to supply the needs of students with print disabilities, it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that resources are scarce and less than desired there, as indeed they are in just about every other aspect of the educational endeavor.
Thank you. Dr. Kircher, you had your hand raised, and I'd like to hear what you have to say in general, but if you could start by responding to what Alan just said about standards and formats. I don't think there's anybody in the room that knows more about that than you.
So in terms of reducing the cost of making the alternative formats and thinking about our long-term goals of the mainstream model, publishers have traditionally had one product, print, and so they've optimized their production processes for that one single product. Now that the digital world is upon us, they have more than one product to produce, and they're re-engineering their production processes. So if we can integrate into the production flow of what publishers do, standard operating procedures that will accommodate needs for accessibility, then one of the byproducts of that can be accessible versions of the books. And publishers have the, you know, once they have the information in a semantically rich XML form, which is the way most publishers are, they're trying to get there, then the transformations that can be done are automated. And this is no longer needing to go to ASCII and things like this. So that could all be facilitated by helping publishers modify their production processes. They could then feed that information, that content, into libraries serving people who are blind and print disabled. I'll call them trusted intermediaries at this point. They can also produce accessible products themselves for sale, which is where we want to get to. I think that Braille is going to take some handwork for a long time. If it's simple, we can highly automate that production process. But if it's math and science and tactile graphics, there's going to be quite a bit of manual work. Of course, the exceptions there, copyright exceptions that are available, can be used in most cases. But even here, I think that the melding of publisher processes working hand in glove with organizations serving people with disabilities is the right place we want to get to. And I think that the copyright exceptions and working with publishers are the right space to be in. I don't see that a copyright exception is opposed to a mainstream model. I think they can both work together. And people with disabilities depend on their libraries to get the information they need. People with disabilities trust those libraries, and working with publishers to build products for sale is where we want to be.
Thank you. Before we move to Paul, Steve, do you have any follow-up for anybody who's spoken so far?
I'm going to ask a couple more questions after we're done with this this line of thought, but I'll
then we'll go to Paul Aiken and then back to Ellen Adler.
Thank you. Mr. LaBarre brought up the Kindle 2, which I want to use to illustrate how the emerging ebook technology and text-to-speech can be used to create a real opportunity for trade books anyway. It doesn't really address textbooks. A real opportunity to really drive down the costs of providing audio versions. Again, this would be using the Chafee Amendment in a creative but justifiable way, we believe. And that would be to allow users with Kindles to have certified print disabilities to go to the websites of some of the organizations around the table here, members-only websites, and activate their Kindle so that text-to-speech would always be on. There would be an override. Right now, what's going on with Amazon and its Kindle 2 is it has two operating systems, one with the text-to-speech always on, the second that apparently is in beta testing with text-to-speech that can be selectively disabled where contractual rights call for that. What we would like to see is a method where version A is available to users with certified print disabilities, and it would be simply a matter of verifying that, activating your Kindle, text-to-speech would be available to all those with print disabilities who have the Kindle or who have a similar device that might be developed by Sony or someone else. We think this is a simple matter technologically. It could be ready before Amazon has its blind accessible Kindle ready. Right now, the Kindle is not accessible for the visually impaired, for many of the visually impaired, because there's no Braille keyboard, there's no audible menu commands. And this has tremendous advantages for everyone, including making it immediately available to the blind. Hundreds of thousands of books at a very low cost and driving down the cost for all users.
Thank you. Alan, do the publishers agree with the Authors Guild on that?
Well, the publishers, I think, agree that with the Authors Guild, to the extent that there are a thicket of contract issues involved with respect to figuring out exactly what the publisher can do with a book in terms of distribution in the particular form involved. But actually, I wanted to just tie on to something that George said before about the need for transition within the publishing community, because that's another important area from which to perceive the question about adequacy of resources. As George said, publishers have had to keep one foot firmly planted in the traditional area of print publication because that still is, without question, their primary market. Despite the hyperbole of a few years ago, e-books and audiobooks combined have not amounted to even, I think, 1% of the current market for publishing in the commercial sector. And so when you're talking about having to retool in order to be able, for example, to meet the requirements of an XML-based format for producing these materials, as the IDEA amendments required, we were told and we had hoped that if we had a uniform approach, a uniform standard, a uniform file format, it would speed the ability of publishers to transition. It would also lighten the level of work that had to be done by those who would be using the authority of Chafee to create specialized formatted versions out of the source files provided by publishers. But it hasn't all worked out that way. Publishers have not done the transitioning as quickly as we had hoped. And in terms of the ability of those who are supposed to use XML-based source files, files based on the NIMIS standard, we found that their learning curve didn't keep up. And you're now giving a fairly sophisticated file format to people who were used to using ASCII files or Word files and are not really able to use NIMIS files. And then finally, I'd also like to say that there is an important point about the diversity within the publishing community itself. We all know that publishing is a sectoral community, so education publishing is different than trade publishing, and both of those are very different than professional and scholarly publishing. But you also have to look at the range of economic situations of publishers. It's hard to get really accurate statistics on this, but according to the Census Bureau in 2006, there were over 3,000 separate firms that called themselves book publishers in this country. Well over two-thirds of them had fewer than 10 employees. So you have to understand the level of size. You're talking about something that requires a certain amount of expense in terms of the ability not only to set up a business, but if you have to convert a business, if you have to transition your production facilities in which you've already invested. For some members of the publishing community, this is more difficult than others.
Okay. Dr. Kircher, coming from your platform of same book, same time, same price, could you respond to Paul Aiken's suggestion that the Authors Guild work with certified websites so that certified Chafee users can have text-to-speech functional on the Kindle?
This is a call for a national registration of all people with disabilities. And, you know, for example, Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, we have a registered user base. You know, they're library card holders. So everybody would in the United States with a disability would have to register with RFB&D and then get access to the Kindle. I don't know if we want a national registry of all people with disabilities. That seems pretty outrageous to me. A lot of people want to use the feature. They have problems admitting that they have disabilities. I know when I was, you know, starting to use a cane, it was embarrassing, and it took me a long time to accept my disability. Older adults, many times, will never accept that they've got a disability. They can't read any longer. They just say, "Oh, I'm not blind. I just can't read anymore." You know, and we saw in the recent statistics from Kindle users, they're over the age of 50. The WhisperNet, which is drop dead easy to use for people to get the books, they don't have to go through a computer. I mean, that's huge. People could transition easily into using text-to-speech when they need to. Forcing them to register as having a disability seems onerous. It also seems to reduce the uptake of ebooks. Ebooks have been for a long time trying to compete toe-to-toe against print books. And print books, you know, the display is very good. So Kindle's got an okay display. So does the Sony e-reader, but it still can't match a tree book. The we want to have ebooks compete with the features and functions that digital technology enables: automatic lookup of words, text to speech, any size font you want, and to start taking away features and restricting that technology would reduce adoption of a nascent industry.
Okay, thank you very much. It's almost 10 to 11, so Steve, if it's okay with you, I'd like to switch gears and talk about DRM, and we can circle back. Does that work for you?
Can I ask one more?
Sure. Sorry. You can ask one more.
I want to try and bring the discussion back to close full circle before we get too far afield. So I appreciate your indulgence. It sounds to me like we're hearing two models about how to work with between publishers and the community that needs the accessible content.
One is to have the publishers produce it in-house in a form that can be used, like the XML. The other, conceivably, is to have some sort of licensing arrangement where organizations like the American Printing House for the Blind or the RFBD or others can receive the content and produce it themselves subject to some sort of licensing arrangement. And I'm wondering if, you know, the reason I ask the questions about the market condition is to find out, is, and this is my bottom line question, is there a viable market in which either of those scenarios can produce a working economic system for the voluntary private sector production of accessible works?
Mr. Chapman, do you want to take that one?
I was listening carefully as you asked the question, trying in my mind to say, do I have an answer to that? And I think, simply put, I don't have an answer. My own company is working on something called HTMLbook, which in the second panel I'll be displaying. And one of the questions that we have is what is the viable market for it? And the simple answer is we don't know. So we have plans, and again, we'll talk about this further in the second panel, have plans to roll it out in a measured fashion. And then we will have a better answer. But just like any other company, we can't heavily invest in an expensive new technology and process, as was pointed out by Mr. Kershaw earlier, without some assurance that it's going to produce a reasonable return on our investment. So I don't know.
Okay. Well, it does set us up nicely for the second panel. Does anybody else want to respond to that? Mr. Labar.
Very briefly. I think I'm going to respectfully suggest that this is the wrong analysis and the wrong question.
At the wrong time.
And well, perhaps, yes, if we keep that framework. This is not a matter of expense or cost. This is a matter of civil rights. This is a matter of being able to participate fully in an integrated fashion in our society. I'm not saying that cost doesn't matter, but cost cannot be the matter.
Can I add to that very quickly?
Sure.
And this is what I was getting at a little bit in the quick wrap-up of my comments. We're sort of approaching it in a cold calculation of access, which in the area of education, which is where we're primarily focused, is really the opposite of where special education law is going. Special education law has evolved, especially with the last iteration of IDEA in 2004, from focusing solely on getting students the accommodations they need to determining whether or not those accommodations are leading to meaningful outcomes. In other words, if access is great, but if access doesn't lead to anything else, then it's rather meaningless. So I think in whatever discussion about models that we have, we need to keep in mind that organizations like ours, like APH, like others, have an expertise here that is a value add beyond simply getting materials into students' hands. We want to make sure, of course, that first and foremost they have the materials, but beyond that, that they know how to use the materials to maximize their education, and that their teachers, in particular, have the knowledge to use those materials appropriately.
Okay. Michelle, the floor is yours.
Great. I'd like to turn to a topic that was raised in a number of comments and was also mentioned, Ms. Ragnath, by you during your opening remarks, and that is the question of digital rights management applied to e-books, and specifically the Section 1201 e-book exemption that already exists. There are a number of proposals in comments to make that exemption permanent or to extend it to the distribution of tools to circumvent digital rights management, or DRM, And what we're interested in learning today is more detail about evidence that supports a need there, a need to go beyond the existing exception to add these additional elements. What kind of evidence is there that at this point the DRM on e-books has interfered with providing access for the blind and other persons with disabilities? So I guess I would direct this question initially to the representatives of Public Knowledge and NFB, because those organizations commented on this issue, but we'd certainly be interested in hearing anyone else on the panel about what kind of evidence is out there that there's a need in this area.
Right. Well, the representatives for the blind are better positioned to say how e-books has actually interfered and not allowed them access to DRM, to the e-books. But the Copyright Office has also observed that a large number of e-books are wrapped in DRM and do not permit access, both in the 2003 and 2006 proceedings. And everyone here has testified about lack of access to the blind and how the blind cannot access books and other publications in the same manner and to the same extent as the rest of, as sighted individuals can. So that proves a need for doing whatever we can to enable such access. And if circumventing DRM is an easy way out and overcomes some of the limitations of Section 121, then adopting laws and regulations that would enable such access is a good thing.
And I would add that it is truly ironic situation when a text in one way or the other is produced in an electronic format. And because of the DRM, screen reading software, for example, doesn't work. And therefore I can't get access, or a blind person can't get access. And that's why I believe we would support the permanency of the exceptions in this regard. This is obviously something that needs further discussion and would have to go through a process, it's just wholly ironic when the book is there and you could use it, but because of the DRM, you can't. And I guess another point too is, it's this notion that that some people bring to the table that using some sort of assistive technology is a different kind of intellectual process or intellectual property that has to be dealt with separately. Using such assistive technology, for example, or text-to-speech, it is our access. It is our way of putting our eyes on the object.
All right, let's take a list for Michelle. So I've got Mr. Chapman. Who else wanted to speak? Dr. Kircher. Oh, I'm sorry, Alan, were you first?
Yeah.
So I've got Alan, Mr. Chapman, Dr. Kircher, anybody else?
AAP, I think, took the position back in 2003 that the 1201A proceeding really was mixing apples and oranges when it was talking about accessibility in the context of the use of technological protection measures by copyright owners, and when you're talking about access for people with print disabilities. And we had pointed out to the Copyright Office at that time that Congress had already dealt with the issue of access with respect to people with print disabilities in the Copyright Act by the enactment of the Chafee Amendment. And the rules of the consideration of the 1201A proceeding under the DMCA were that we were supposed to be looking at the question of whether or not the prohibition against circumventing access controls under that statute was adversely affecting the use of a class of works. The Copyright Office, I think, in its attempt to do good in this area, basically had to distort its own interpretive rules for that proceeding
by changing it into a question of looking at a class of users rather than a class of works. Digital rights management technology is still necessary for some types of distribution of works, but not others. And the marketplace is the only place where you can find out the extent to which that is going to evolve. For example, with respect to audiobooks, for some reason or another, audiobooks recently have largely foregone the use of DRM technology without any kind of negative result in terms of increased unauthorized reproduction and distribution of works in those forms. With respect to e-books, I don't think that the market has demonstrated that that would necessarily be the case with e-books without the use of DRM. We're finding e-books in terms of unauthorized websites and peer-to-peer file sharing are using e-books. E-books themselves, we have to remember, are not the technological product of publishers, but they're the technological product of publishers collaborating with hardware and software manufacturers. And at the moment, the hardware and software manufacturers are in battle with each other for proprietary dominance. So e-books have not been able to rise to the level of consumer acceptance that we otherwise thought they might, because you do not yet have a situation for consumers where the use of an e-book is seamless, transparent, and interoperable. As long as you still have to worry whether a particular author's work is available in a particular format that will play on a particular device, you're not going to really be thinking of that product as a substitute for the work in print form. So I think that while we recognize there are problems with accessibility that are caused by digital rights management technology, particularly in connection with the e-book, one of the things that I pointed out in the 2003 DMCA proceeding was that that can be viewed as a competitive factor in the marketplace. Whether or not a publisher, whether or not an author chooses to make the work available in that form so that it is accessible through the use of read-aloud functionality is something that consumers can decide is a good or bad thing. But to decide that you're going to have to require that either you forego DRM technology but still put those products into the marketplace, which places at least some publishers at risk of seeing their investment reduced by unauthorized reproduction and distribution, or whether you're going to mandate what kind of DRM technology can be used and how it can be used, specifically with respect to literary works being distributed in electronic form, I think is again, a product, a byproduct of the regulatory approach that probably we would be able to see reduced if we moved away from the regulatory approach to a more market-based approach for making these types of products available.
Mr. Chapman.
I'd like to echo some of the statements Mr. Adler just made. You talked earlier about the diversity across the publishing industry. Pearson, my company, is a very large company. We have diversity within the company. We represent trade, we have textbooks, higher ed, K-12, international, and U.S. And within my own company, there is that same diversity of opinion as to how we should approach DRM. In some cases, perhaps it's very important, in others, it isn't. And one of the things that I need to do as a person who's involved with creating the platform on which our ebooks will be produced is I now pay more attention than I ever did to the blogosphere. And I religiously now read a lot of the comments on the Kindle. And some of them are very well informed, many of them are foolish. But there is a common theme amongst many of them, and that is what a wonderful opportunity this is going to be for us to not pay for our textbooks. In other words, an ability to pirate textbooks. And the sophomoric analysis goes something like the reader costs $400 or $500, my textbook costs $400 or $500 per semester. Therefore, I'm all set. I'll just get one of these. I think many of you are aware that the Kindle allows, under certain circumstances, the right to copy off the Kindle onto another device. So even if the e-book was intended only for those with disabilities, which we would clearly support, there is certainly the opportunity for it to leak into the broader market. And you only need to look at some of the other industries, like the recording industry, to know that things can rapidly deteriorate. And that hasn't happened yet, but we're mindful of that, and that's why it's an important issue to us.
Mr. Kirscher? Or Dr. Kirscher, sorry.
DRM is a complicated issue. and the ability to crack, if I have a lawful copy of an ebook that I cannot use because of the DRM, I could crack it, and I have done that. But we are trying, we in the disability community and the libraries, all the trusted intermediaries who have the potential to write such software, have not done so because we want to work hand in glove with the publishing community and not disrupt the ecosystem that's evolving. So we've not implemented the nuclear threat. And that's kind of what we refer to it as, is the implementation of the of that exception. We're trying to work on interoperable DRM. We're beginning to see, now the Kindle has got deals with the iPhone, the Adobe Digital Editions is using the same DRM on the Sony e-reader, and Adobe has a DRM software kit that would allow interoperability. These are all within a proprietary system. But what we have to have are user agents, reading systems, either PC-based or handheld, that will allow a person with a disability to use it effectively. So sharing the certificates or keys with different devices that could render the content in an appropriate way. We have to get to the point where we can interchange information on various devices, trusted, you know, devices that are paying attention to the digital rights management. I think we have to have that kind of system somewhere. Until we get to the DRM free market, which is where, you know, I think a lot of people would like to see us. O'Reilly is not doing DRM on their books, and they're many times a leader in this regard. But I know that many publishers feel that it's not yet time for DRM free materials. Thank you.
Okay, I have a question. Mr. Martin Nengo of Accessible Publishing filed extensive comments. He couldn't be here today. He said, government policy over the years has favored institutional accessibility at the expense of mainstream accessibility, with the result that more emphasis has been given to nonprofit and government-produced materials rather than creating the right economic incentives for books to be issued in accessible formats by the original publisher. So in the next panel, we'll ask the content producers, what are the right economic incentives? That's not for this panel. But my question really is, we've heard a range of the Chafee Amendment is working beautifully, the Chafee Amendment is working fine, but from here forward, we should focus on market. And even, I believe, Mr. Chapman, that the Chafee Amendment has lived its purpose. So I invite anybody to kind of comment on that general theme about the existing regulatory provisions for the next few minutes. We'd like to hear more about that. Alan.
Well, let's go back for a minute and look at the Chafee Amendment in 1996 when it was enacted. The Chafee Amendment was enacted in 1996 primarily with the objective of being able to eliminate one of the things that added to the amount of time it would take for people to be able to obtain literary works in specialized formats that would serve accessibility needs. And so by eliminating the need to obtain permission from the copyright owner for reproducing these works in specialized formats, of course, the question also came up, although it was not dealt with specifically in the statute, does that also mean that in addition to eliminating permission, you're also eliminating any right to compensation? And basically, that is the way it has worked, although I note that in many instances, particularly in dealing in the educational environment, people think that it is fair to purchase, for example, a textbook or to purchase another book that's been assigned for curriculum reading before one is going to use that book either to be scanned or to otherwise be retrofitted in some way to meet the needs of a specialized formatted version. The problem is that we had concepts that in 1996 have evolved, and they've changed the way the law works entirely. For example, when we talked about specialized formats, what was inherently understood about the specialized format, indeed the concept of the specialized format, that it was a form of the work that could be used by somebody with print disabilities that would not be used by someone without those disabilities in the marketplace, because typically you required special equipment in order to be able to use any of those specialized formats, whether you were talking about cassette tapes or digital text or Braille. So we've moved away from that notion now because I think it's pretty clear as technology has evolved, we're coming to see that I would venture that the preferred format today is some version of a digital talking book, typically based on the DAISY standard, but now even based on the NIMAS standard, something that for the publishing community is coming increasingly and uncomfortably closer to what a commercial ebook or a commercial audiobook provides. So we've moved away from the concept of specialized format. We've also moved away from the concept that was understood in 1996 as to who exactly what was the definition of the population that was supposed to benefit from this copyright exemption. That population was defined in terms of the print disabilities community as that population had been defined for the National Library Service under existing statutes and regulations. What we've now seen, however, is constant pressure to evolve towards a broader population, not print disabilities, but a population with learning disabilities, that depending upon whose estimates you look at, in any event, are exponentially larger than the population that was understood in 1996 to constitute the print disabilities community. Now, that's an important fact because an inherent principle of the Chafee Amendment, an underlying premise, was that there really was no marketplace for specialized formats. It was noted in testimony by the Register at that time that Braille was something that was almost entirely subsidized by the government. It wasn't produced by private entities in any kind of a commercial capacity. And the same thing was true for the other specialized formats that were specifically identified in the Chafee Amendment and contemplated as the kinds of things that required special equipment to use and would not be used by ordinary consumers. But now, as we've moved not only to a change in the population of an exponentially larger population that could, in fact, constitute a market, a legitimate, viable market, for accessible books to be produced in the first instance. And as we've moved towards a specialized format that no longer requires specialized equipment in every instance to be utilized, but in fact can be utilized and even might be attractive to be utilized by ordinary consumers, you have to ask the question of whether or not the regulatory approach and the framework and the underlying premises of that approach in the Chafee Amendment still have general validity, especially such that you'd want to extend them for application overseas.
Thank you. Mr. O'Reilly, could I ask you to explain to us in a little more detail about the population that you serve? Are they folks that are happy with specialized equipment and are set in their ways, or are they a potential market? Are they a mixed crowd? Who are they?
Well, I think you'd get a number of different answers to that depending on who you ask, and I think we have our information is what word could I use, imprecise, but our sense is that our readership on the whole is about, I think, 65-70% over the age of 60 or 65. Our readership is generally speaking, technologically unsophisticated. Our readership is, generally speaking, close to indigent, and perhaps would not constitute any kind of a market on that basis. I think we also make a distinction between dyslexia that is organically caused as against a psychological issue of I'm out of my depth in the ins and outs of dyslexia, but that's the way it's formulated. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, and Mr. Thomas and Mr. Mudd, feel free to jump in, but really we're just trying to understand the patron.
I think part of what we need to understand is that we don't fit in a box. There aren't, Alan mentioned earlier, there's no one answer to this question. Students who are, that we deal with, the K through 12 population, they're becoming much more savvy with computers. And like George, you know, he can access pretty much with technology whatever he needs to. Because he's an expert user, there are still kids who need Braille, who need to be taught with Braille, and then move into technology for getting more information. Those of us who are blind or visually impaired typically are happy with any way we can get information, and that could be in Braille. It could be with downloading from Bookshare or RFBND. We typically use all kinds of ways to get our information, and none of us can fit in that one box that answers all the questions we're happy with NLS, we're happy with RFBND, we're happy with getting Braille. We just want access to information, and we do want to protect the intellectual property of the authors and the publishers. We don't want anything for free.
And I don't know whether that helps.
Maria, is that addressing the question you had? Okay.
Absolutely. Dr. Kupcher and then Mr. Thomas.
The libraries are potential customers for the publishers that have an accessible product. Right now, you can't buy accessible books. So Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic has to manufacture it. And there's, as we learned, high costs associated with that manufacturing process. There was, if the library could buy it and add it to their collection like a regular library buys a book, there would be no reason for them to spend money manufacturing it. So the copyright exception is there for those titles where we cannot purchase it. And we want to see we hope that the publishers are going to see this emerging market and universally design the product so it's going to work with a whole host of different people with and without disabilities. Then we'd add those titles to our collection. So in fact, as our libraries continue to use the copyright exception to make books accessible that would not otherwise be accessible, we also become a market for the publishers as they create accessible content.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Mr. Thomas and then Mr. Aiken.
Just very quickly, we don't see it as an either-or proposition, and I think this has been articulated already. We certainly believe that a copyright exemption will need to continue to exist. We believe that we have value add to the process. We believe that we have a technical expertise that, while is developing rapidly within certain segments of the publishing industry, is not, as we've heard, yet completely viable. But that said, we certainly recognize the need for mainstream access, as you cited originally, and think that we have an important role to play in that, and I would like to be a part of that evolving process.
Okay, Paul.
Thank you. Yeah, we don't think any changes need to be made to the law. No new regulatory exceptions are needed. And partly because of the proposal we made earlier, which would make DRM'd books accessible using modern devices to the blind and visually impaired, and respecting our legitimate markets at the same time. To Dr. Kirscher's assertion that we're proposing establishing a national registry, this is just untrue. We're not. There's an existing framework under CHAFE, and our proposal is to leverage that. And this is not a network of of faceless bureaucrats. These are trusted intermediaries. A lot of the nonprofits that are around this table that are involved. It's decentralized. There already is an existing list. Those people would be entitled to an additional benefit as a result of having their certifications. So we think it's a elegant and simple and inexpensive solution to providing access for hundreds of thousands of books within a very short period of time to the blind and visually impaired.
Dr. Kirscher, did you want to respond to that?
Thank you. Reading my mind. I would benefit by that, but there's the majority of people who need to use this technology would not be registering. So you'd be forcing them into a situation to use a mainstream technology that it was designed, the e-book specification was designed to be used with text-to-speech and is being turned off, amounts to me, turning off a fundamental human right to access information. So I see that we've got a rights conflict here between the recording rights that have been sold and the fundamental human right to access the information that I've paid for.
Paul, maybe you could speak a little more about contracts prospectively, because obviously you're dealing with existing contracts and emerging business models and they're all coming together, but is there any thought about how this might change over time contractually?
Sure, and I do want to point out again that the existing contracts still do have the exception in them so that authors do donate rights, as they have for decades, to allow Braille and audio versions be created without royalties being paid to authors. But potentially those exceptions could be expanded contractually. But that will take a discussion from a lot of people figuring out exactly how to do that in a way that does not disrupt the market. We have to bear in mind that we're at the dawn of this market. We're just beginning. And the worst thing we could do is to come in with a new regulatory framework that could impede the market and prevent market-based solutions from answering many of these problems. And we think the answer is instead to look to contracts, to talk to the people who are around this table, and work out something that works for everyone that can be implemented contractually.
Can I just do a quick follow-up with Mr. Aiken, and that was you'd mentioned Amazon. Did you say Amazon is developing an accessible version of the Kindle 2 or that they would need to? I just wanted to clarify the situation with that technology.
Right. There's two parts of the accessibility. One is the physical accessibility of the device itself. And what we've heard, I haven't had it verified, but what we've heard is that they are developing an accessible version of the device itself, presumably with a Braille keyboard and audible menu commands. The other side is the software side. And, of course, that part has been solved. There's a version of Kindle's operating system that permits text-to-speech, and apparently there's another version in that's in beta testing right now that would allow selective turning off of text-to-speech where it's contractually required.
Okay. I've got Ms. Rangmuth followed by Dr. Kircher, and we're getting towards 11:30, so if anybody else wants to speak on this panel, Alan, Mr. Labar, raise your hand now, or you're out of luck. Okay.
Just want to point out that when we talk about rights and audio rights, we should be mindful of the fact that these rights may not be copyright rights, and they may not be publishers and authors might not have these rights. The Copyright Office has observed in 2003 that the audio rights in ebooks were a private performance right, which is not covered by, which is not a right given to the copyright owner. So we have to be mindful of that limitation when we're talking about marketplace and what rights are implicated and what damage is being caused to the publisher.
The Kindle 2 is accessible to some people with disabilities right now, and we've seen that some students with disabilities have, at higher ed have found a few of their books in the Amazon collection. But people who are blind, all the controls are visual. So a portion of the disabled population can use the Kindle, and in talks with Amazon, their intent was, and they blogged about, making the rest of it accessible. And now with the Kindle DX, the bigger one that they've announced targeted toward education, boy, I would think if they don't make those controls accessible, they're going to run into a lot of controversy.
Thank you. Mr. Labar, you have the last word for this panel.
I just wanted to...
Oh, I'm sorry. You have the last word for this panel.
Fine.
Followed by Ellen Adler.
I have the penultimate word, I guess. It appears... obviously, when Chafee was adopted, we didn't have the current reality of the emerging technology and e-text to the degree we have now. But as we wrote in our comments submitted by Dr. Maurer, we believe that correctly interpreted, Chafee amendments do apply to e-text. However, we also agree that needs to be clarified and perhaps with some sort of regulatory guidance. We also believe that the issue of regarding what kinds of organizations can produce these books is perhaps another issue that needs to be clarified. The whole idea of having a primary mission. Clearly, somebody like RFB&D has a It is their mission. But it could be argued that when a disabled student services office on a college campus is attempting to convert a book into electronic format for a student, that it would constitute a primary mission of that particular entity. So there needs to be some clarification in that regard.
Okay. Thank you, and Alan.
Well, I just wanted to follow up a comment Scott made before when he was talking about the cost issue should not be paramount in determining how people who have print disabilities are able to have their needs for information served, and I agree with that. But I think cost comes into it in the sense that on the one hand, we hear Ed O'Reilly saying that he thinks the population he serves probably is largely one that might not be able to afford universal design products that have built-in accessibility in the marketplace. On the other hand, I assume that the controversy over Kindle 2 indicates that there is, in fact, a market out there, and there are ready and waiting consumers who have print disabilities who wanted to be able to purchase the Kindle 2 and make full use of all of its capabilities. So the question that comes back to us, and I just didn't want to leave the subject of the Chafee Amendment without this, is ultimately whether or not we can move forward fully into a market-based universal design product environment while you still have a lingering regulatory approach in the form of an exemption to the Copyright Act that explicitly authorizes certain people to be able to reproduce and distribute copies of the work without permission or paying compensation as long as those copies meet the definition of specialized format. And at that point, is an ebook a specialized format? Because it certainly provides the needs of accessibility. Is a digital talking book under the DAISY standard a specialized format, which now can be reproduced? Obviously, if that's the case, then one can readily see the problem from the publisher's perspective in making the investment in producing those versions as a product for the marketplace when there still is a regulatory exemption that allows people to freely reproduce and distribute them in competition.
But, Alan, to the extent that the publishers are not distributing all books that are available in that format, is the regulatory scheme not important?
Well, I mean, you know, it may well be, you may always need it as some sort of a safety net, even if you had a full-blown marketplace working with accessible, universal design products. But we're talking here about why it is that publishers haven't been able to achieve that kind of marketplace. And I'm simply submitting to you that part of the problem is the continuing existence of this regulatory approach that says there's an exemption to copyright that will let people reproduce and distribute copies of those very works, those universally designed, accessible works.
Thank you. We are out of time on this panel. We are going to take a 10-minute break. So if everybody could be back at 11:40, we would appreciate it. Thank you.